You ought to be turning in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, verses 1 through 12. While you're turning, I noticed I had two different Bibles. Both of them had this. Most of them have a caption at the top of a chapter, even though it just says, avoid Israel's mistakes. It says, for I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also crave. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall.
Thank you, Gerald. And appropriate comments by him at the beginning of this section, because that's what my Bible says as well. Avoid Israel's mistakes, and that certainly is why I had Gerald read that entire text. The focus of our lesson is actually on verse 12. But verse 12 has a word there at the very beginning that says, therefore. So something has come before verse 12 that has laid the foundation for this conclusion. And so the question then is, okay, well, what has come before that has laid the foundation for this conclusion of take heed lest he fall? I have on the slide the New King James Version because I just thought that that made a better title than the way that the New American Standard renders it, though there's no difference in meaning. That matter of be careful, be aware, take heed, pay attention, lest something happen to you. Paul says the very first verse, he says, I want you to be aware of some things, brethren. That when you look back over history, that this group of people, and I'm going to call your attention to, that all of them had these same blessings and privileges. So that when we come to verse 5, and it says that with most of them, God was not well pleased, we can't go back and say, well, those are the ones that didn't. Those are the ones that didn't see this, or didn't experience this, or didn't get a chance to witness this. Paul says, no, all passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses. All ate the same spiritual food. All drank the same spiritual drink. All of them had that. All of them experienced that blessing, that privilege. All of them saw that. And then you come to another important word, and that's the word in verse 5, nevertheless. That tells us then that we would have expected them to go in a very different direction than the way that they went, doesn't it? Nevertheless means this, this, and this, but that's not the way that went. It went like this over here. All of them experienced God's blessing. All of them experienced God's power. All of them experienced God's miracles. Nevertheless, God still wasn't pleased with them because of what they did. And to make sure that we understand that this is recorded for a very specific purpose, Paul tells us at the beginning of the list of mistakes that they made, and then he tells us at the end of the list of mistakes that they made. These things happened as examples so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. Verse 6. God wasn't pleased with them because of what they craved, because of what they desired. And so that these examples, these things, these failures, these mistakes are written so that we won't fall in the same path. And so here are their mistakes. 7, 8, 9, 10. In those verses, we have all those mistakes laid out for us. And just to make sure that we don't forget why that we're looking at this, we're told again, these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction. It was Jeremiah that, when he prophesied to the nation of Judah, he talked about the fact that Israel had failed God, the northern kingdom. And because they had failed God, because they had disobeyed God, and because in spite of the fact that God had sent them prophet after prophet after prophet, they ignored the prophet, ignored the warnings, and sure enough, they were carried away into captivity. They're gone now during Jeremiah's day. And Jeremiah looks at his own nation and God says, here is her sister Judah, but God has a name for her, her treacherous sister Judah, who looked to the north and saw what happened when Israel failed to obey him, who could be reminded of the prophets that had been sent to Israel and how that Israel had ignored them. And because of that, God carried them away. And here is Judah. And what's Judah doing? Why is she treacherous? Because she's following the exact same path. You know, when you think about the fact that when we have example after example after example after example of here's what not to do, and then I go and do the same thing, how much stricter is my judgment going to be when I've got all of this evidence piled up as to why I shouldn't have done that? And yet we have the audacity and we have the pride in thinking and the arrogance in thinking, well, that won't happen to me. Even though all the evidence suggests that's exactly what's going to happen to you. And that's exactly what happened with Judah. God says her treacherous sister Judah has seen this and yet it's had no impact upon them. I say pride and I say arrogance because why would it be that after giving an explanation of all of the blessings, all the people received the same blessings, and yet God wasn't pleased with them because they craved evil things, but fortunately that's been recorded for us so that we won't repeat that same mistake. Why then, at the end of that entire text, why is it that the conclusion is verse 12? Because we are just arrogant enough to think, oh, well, that won't happen to me. I don't have a problem with that. That'll never be an issue with me. That's why Paul says, therefore, since we have all of this evidence, since it's been written for our example and our instruction, therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he does not fall. What do you have on your side that would be evidence for the fact that if you choose to live this way over here, that these things won't happen to you? What evidence do you have on your side? I'll give you all kinds of evidence on this side that if you choose to live this way and crave these things and act this way, here's what's going to happen. What evidence do you have on your side? I just don't think it'll happen to me. Well, that's poor evidence. Very poor. In fact, it's mistaken evidence. And that's why we find that the Apostle Paul says, you need to take heed lest you be destroyed or lest you fall. I want to think about this from the standpoint of just some similarities that we find between either the Corinthians that Paul was writing to, or more in general, ourselves. One of the similarities that I think I would suggest to you is that their faith should have been strong. Israel should have had, especially this first generation. You know, the second generation or the third generation, all that they would have had would have been the stories, right? The stories of the 10 plagues. They hadn't seen it. The stories of the crossing of the Red Sea. They hadn't been there. The stories of God providing them with food, providing them with water, providing them with manna. They would just have the stories. They wouldn't have seen it. They wouldn't have been of the generation that would have gone out in the morning and gathered the manna. They wouldn't have been the generation that stood around the rock and saw water come out of it. They wouldn't have been the generation that walked down a pathway with the Red Sea on either side. They wouldn't have been of that generation. They would have just heard the stories of that. But we're talking about a generation that saw this. They didn't hear the stories about it. They lived it. And yet, in spite of that, their faith was weak. And that is one of those things that, you know, sometimes we say things that make you go, Well, that's kind of one of these things that just kind of makes you go, How could people see the 10 plagues, see all the power, all the miraculous nature of displayed before them, and see how God took care of them? There's no way they should have survived the journey that they took, and yet God took care of them. They should have starved to death. They should have been dehydrated long before that. And yet God gave them water. God gave them food. God gave them meat. God gave them all. I took care of that. And so their faith in God should have been exponential, shouldn't it? And yet they gripe and complain and murmur, and it's not there whatsoever. Think about the Corinthians. This is the letter that we're reading from and that Paul writes to the Corinthians. How strong should the Corinthians' faith have been? When you go back to Acts chapter 18, where we find the beginning of the church at Corinth, we learn that Paul, there was some opposition, there was some difficulty, but notice that in verse 11 of chapter 18, that he settled there for a year and 6 months teaching the word of God among them. Now, when you begin to make a list of the places that Paul preached at and how long he stayed, Ephesus is the only other place that he stayed longer. He stayed longer, the second longest, here in the town of Corinth. And so you would think then that a church that had had the Apostle Paul work with them for 18 months... teaching them for 18 months, not a month, not two, not six, 18 months Paul was there. You would think that this would be a group of Christians that were strong. There is evidence that their faith should have been strong. Let me give you another similarity. They had received God's care and God's blessings. Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and look at the list of the things that are given to us relative to the blessings of God. They had been given miraculous passage across or through the Red Sea. They had been given guidance with the cloud. They had been given food, spiritual food, in the giving of the law. They had all drank of the same spiritual drink. They had all been taken care of. They had received incredible spiritual blessings. Think about us as children of God. How is it that our blessings are described? Well, in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 through 5, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to His great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are protected by the power of God through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time." Sounds eerily familiar to the first generation of the children of Israel that came out of their bondage, doesn't it? And here's Peter saying, you've come out of your spiritual bondage. Why? Because of great and magnificent promises that God made, just like it had been with the Old Testament, just like it had been with the descendants of Abraham, living on promises. You have received an inheritance. You've received something that is awaiting you. They would have received their rest had they been faithful. We stand in so many ways in the same kind of position that Israel of old did, having received God's care and received God's blessings. There's reason for that, and that's because they were God's chosen people, and we are God's chosen people. There's a reason why God's care and His blessings were bestowed marvelously upon the children of Israel that came out of the land of Egypt. And there's a reason why that we have an incredible amount of spiritual blessings because of God's promise made to us. We've been selected, chosen as God's people. Israel was selected in Exodus chapter 19, in verses 5 and 6. They were told that they themselves were God's special people. In Exodus 19, 5 and 6. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my commandment, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom, a priest, and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. Who is he talking to? This same generation that came out of Israel, or came out of Egypt. This same generation standing at Mount Sinai. And God is telling them, look, I control everything. The world is my possession, but I'm going to make you a special possession. You're going to be special. You're going to have a different kind of relationship with me. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, borrowing from that same kind of terminology, Peter says, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. For you were once not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. In many ways, that equally applied to the children of Israel coming out of the land of Egypt. They were a people, but they weren't really a people, were they? They had no place to go. They had no mercy because they were at the mercy, if you will, of their Egyptian taskmasters. But now they received mercy. And how did they respond? Well, they responded, unfortunately, in disobedience. Their disobedience resulting in their falling. When the Hebrew writer comes and is talking about trying to get people to maintain faithfulness and trying to keep them from falling away, trying to keep them from drifting away, what generation does he go to? The same generation. And he calls the Hebrews' attention back to this generation. And he tells them, take care, brethren, that there not be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God, in verse 12. And then he says to them, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. A quote from Psalm 95. For who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, did not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. Notice that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, when Paul references this same situation and what happened as a result of this first generation falling away, notice that when he says, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. That word, laid low, is actually a compound word, and it just means they were strown. They were just strown. Their bodies were just strown in the wilderness. What God thought of them. Think about that for just a moment. And the picture of that in your mind. This was the group. This was the people that came out of Egypt. They saw all of God's blessings. They saw all of God's privileges. They saw all of this. And a land, a promised land was awaiting them. And yet, what's their end? It's not happy homes in a luscious place where there's fig trees and there are honey and their animals are everywhere. Their houses are well stocked. Their fields are full of grain. Their vineyards are ripened. It's not a wonderful picture. That's how God wanted it to be, wasn't it? God desired that He would bring them out of Egypt, out of slavery, out of terribleness, and bring them to a land flowing with milk and honey. And that's how that was supposed to end. How does it end? With their bodies strewn in the wilderness. That's how it ended. They were laid low, is what Paul says. They were destroyed because they didn't learn better. Christians are told, both in the Hebrew letter and in the Corinthian letter, not to be like them. So how is it then that as we look at our walk with the Lord, that we might find ourselves faltering or drifting just a bit? I'm going to give you four quick things that I think sometimes, they're not sin, but it starts us down a pathway where we begin to falter. I want to suggest to you, first of all, that one of the things that sometimes people will do, and it causes them not to really examine themselves, and they begin to think that they're okay, and as much of Israel must have thought that they were okay, because there's always strength in numbers, right? And so sometimes people think, well, I'm okay. I don't really need to take heed, because I'm not on the verge of falling. I'm not on the verge of losing my faith. Why? Well, because everyone thinks I'm fine. And so if everyone thinks I'm fine, there's no real need for me to heed the warning in verse 12 of taking heed, paying attention, examine myself to see if maybe I'm falling. Jesus reminds the people in Luke chapter 6 and verse 26. He says, "Woe to you when all men speak well of you." For their fathers used to treat the false prophets in that same way. That doesn't validate anything, what Jesus is saying. Well, they all speak well of me. Well, they spoke well of the false prophets too. We know how that turned out. That doesn't validate anything. Well, everybody thinks I'm a pretty good guy. Well, they all thought the false prophets were pretty good people too. That doesn't validate anything. Why is it that we need to stick our finger up and see which way the wind is blowing? Why is it that we need to take a public opinion poll and based upon the public opinion poll, therefore whatever they say must be okay? Why is it that I need to ask 10 different people and if they think that I'm a fine guy, then I must be a fine guy? Because I'm equating others' approval as God's approval. And so they looked at the false prophets and who was more popular during the time of Jeremiah? Jeremiah or the prophets that prophesied against him? Well, it wasn't Jeremiah. And yet who was speaking the truth? Jeremiah. And so popularity is a very fickle thing. And when I look at that, I think, well, if others approve, that must mean God approved. Boy, be careful with that. You're investigating it from the wrong perspective. You know, in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 1, what was the reputation of that church, the church in Sardis? Well, it was very different than what Jesus looked at it. He says, "I know that you have a reputation, that you have a name." So, if we were to pull the brotherhood in the Asia Minor district, you would have said, "Boy, that church of Sardis, man, they're a strong church. Boy, that church of Sardis, I tell you what, they've got a name, they're strong, they're sound," and yet God comes to them and says, "I'm telling you, you're dead. You're dead." What about Cornelius? Here's a fellow that, for all accounts, was a good individual. Verse 22, we are told in reference to him that Cornelius was a centurion. He was a righteous and God-fearing man, well spoken of by the entire nation of the Jews. What did the Jews think of that? Now think about who they're bragging on. This is not another Jew. They're bragging on a Roman soldier. The very man that represents Roman occupation in their territory. And yet, he had set himself apart in such a way that even the Jews spoke highly of him. That's impressive. But I want you to notice that when you get over into chapter 11 and verse 14, and Peter has already visited there, Peter has already preached, he's already converted them, and Peter's explaining himself. Notice that Peter says, regarding this, "And behold, at that moment, three men appeared at the house in which we were staying, having been sent to me." Well, I got the wrong reference. Maybe it's supposed to be 10. "Where words by which he and his household must be saved." Verse 14. I'm reading the wrong verse. "And he will speak words to you by which you will be saved, you and all your household." So here's an individual that was spoken well of by all of those that were around him. And yet what did he still need? Words of salvation presented to him. So that tells you that everyone else may approve, oh, Cornelius, you couldn't find a better one. Why? He is the epitome of a fine prince of a man, even though he's Roman. He's a man that we didn't think there could be such a Roman like that. We didn't think there could be centurions like that. Everyone, even the Jews, approved of him. And yet, God knew, well, he hasn't met my approval yet. There's still some words that he needs to hear, that he needs to obey in order to be saved. Be careful, brethren, when we begin to equate others' approval as God's approval. We better take heed lest we fall. There's a second thing that I would suggest to you, and that is we begin to minimize the corrupting effect of evil company. And we start doing that, and we start justifying and rationalizing or making light of, or we just minimize it as if that's not that big of a deal. Then we have set ourselves up for falling. We've set ourselves up because we're not taking heed as we should. And when we do that, then eventually it will run its course and it will have its impact. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, this was an area in which Paul was concerned, and he calls it an area of self-deception. He says that it's a place wherein I might deceive myself into thinking this won't happen. Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. I can almost hear that. Yeah, but. And if you're thinking that, and I would suggest to you, you've already fallen into the very thing that Paul said we need to be careful of. You're not taking heed. Well, I haven't fallen. Not saying you have. Well, I'm not sinned. Not saying you have. I'm just telling you, you have started down the wrong path. And you may not have done anything yet. And you may not have sinned. But I'm telling you, your attitude and your disposition and your faith is being undermined just a little. You know, when you get these timers in games and their little hourglass of sand, that thing, you can watch it, and it's just ever so slightly losing sand. It's not a huge jump. It doesn't just belch from one end of it to the other end. I mean, it's just ever so slightly. That's exactly what Paul is saying here. We have an area sometimes of self-deception in that I minimize, well, it's not having an impact on me. It's not really affecting me. I can guarantee you that it is. Because I can guarantee you that if I were to look at you 2 years ago and look at you now, and you've been in this situation, or 1 year ago and look at you now, or sometimes just 6 months ago and look at you now, I can guarantee you there is an impact. Something has changed. And it may very well be that you will look at yourself and say, well, I don't think anything's changed. But if someone else has come to you and say, wow, you're not the person that I new. You're not the person that you once were. You're not the person that you were last week. Sometimes it can happen that way. Oh, we got to be careful. What's interesting about it is that, you know, Israel received the same warning. They were going to a land that there was going to be people around them. You know, wouldn't it be great to just be in a bubble? I'm not sure how we'd be very evangelistic in a bubble, but wouldn't it be great that we just, you know, we can't do that. But we can limit the amount of influence that others have upon us. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside from a multitude in order to pervert justice. Don't follow what everybody else is doing. Numbers chapter 25, in verses 1 and 2. We find that Israel didn't learn that, though. In fact, they didn't even learn that. And they didn't even get to the land of Canaan. They hadn't even learned it. They'd already forgotten it. When Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. It's not been that long since they just got the order, don't do this. Don't act this way. Don't follow them. And yet here they are doing the very thing that God had said not do. When we began to minimize the corrupting effect of evil company, it signals not that our faith has fallen, it's just faltering. There's a third thing that I would suggest to you, and that is we begin to be neglectful, we get a little complacent, and we get apathetic. And when that happens, it's not that it may be neglectful in every area, or complacent in every area, or an apathetic in every area, but just one area or two areas, and it begins and starts a pattern that eventually will spread over into all areas of our faith. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 17. The church in Laodicea said, because you say, I am rich and I have become wealthy and have need of nothing, and yet you do not know that you are wretched, miserable, and poor, and blind, and naked. These individuals thought that they weren't anything like what Jesus said. You know, I've often wondered that as they were the last letter that was written to these seven churches, I've often wondered if I'd have been a member of the church in Laodicea, and as I was sitting there listening to whoever it was that had brought this scroll and was reading this scroll, I've often wondered, as we always do, and we heard this church get praised, this church gets rebuked, this church gets praised for this church gets rebuked, and you begin to think, I bet I know what he's going to say about us. I bet I know what he has in mind for the church in Laodicea. And I wonder if maybe that's why God left them to last. To set them up so that they were, the more that they heard what was being said about other churches, yeah, boy, I tell you, wait till we get to us. Man, I tell you, we're going to be impressed. Just brought that level of confidence up to the point where Jesus could say, I know what you think. And I know what you think about your deeds. And I'm telling you, you are lukewarm. Wonder how that would have went. What would you think the faces of the audience of those at the church must have looked like when they got that? And I know you think that you are this, but I'm telling you that you are this. In Psalm, I know that the exact situation isn't an exact parallel, but there is a struggle that Asaph had in Psalm 73. And his struggle was that, well, it seems as though everybody is wicked and everybody is unholy, and so what is the use? Seems to be Asaph's struggle. What's the use in staying righteous? It seems like the wicked are getting away with murder, if you will. And it was a struggle for him because it says, as for me, verse 2, my feet came close to stumbling. My steps had almost slipped. For I was envious of the arrogant and saw the prosperity of the wicked. And so it caused Asaph almost to become neglectful of God and almost become complacent about, well, what's the point of worshiping if the wicked get this and I get this? But I want you to notice how Asaph solved this. He said in verse 24, with your counsel you will guide me and afterward receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And besides you, I desire nothing on earth. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For behold, those who are far from you will perish. You have destroyed all those who are unfaithful to you. But as for me, the nearness of God is my good. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell all of your works. I think key in that, at least for me, maybe there's another key point in that section for you. I think key for me is verse 8, but as for me, the nearness of God is my good. When Asaph understood that the critical thing for him was maintaining his nearness to God, and that meant that he couldn't be neglectful, that he couldn't be complacent, he couldn't be apathetic. It also meant that he needed to change his view of some things, and he needed to be reminded of the fact that, yes, what they're enjoying now won't be what they enjoy in the end, because in the end they're going to perish. And what's critical for me is my nearness to God. And everything that I do and every choice and decision that I make reflects that what's important is my nearness to God, because if I do that, I can handle this. If I keep God as my refuge, then I can get through the difficulties of life. I don't see neglectfulness there. I don't see complacency there. I don't see apathy there. But when I begin to get apathetic and complacent and neglectful, guess what? My nearness to God becomes farness from God. Little by little, I'm pulling away from the very thing that will give me the strength that I need. Finally, sometimes I think that when we bring stuff up like this to people, they'll say, well, I've not stopped believing. Okay, well, that's not really my point. My point is that you've stopped believing. My point is, I didn't say that you don't have faith. I just said that your faith is faltering. I didn't say that you don't believe. But I want you to notice that Jesus said, and the Bible equates belief with obedience. Luke chapter 6 and verse 46. Why do you call me Lord, Lord? Why do you say that you believe that and yet do not do the things that I say? Matthew's account words it as a statement. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. We would even look to James chapter 2 and say, well, okay, if it's just a matter of I accept that Jesus is Lord, okay, that's fine. Well, the demons do that too, and they're not going to be saved. So it's got to be more than, well, I'm not stopped believing in Jesus, that's fine, but are you obeying him? In Hebrews chapter 3, you'll notice that the Hebrew writer uses these terms interchangeably, because in the Bible they are interchangeable. True belief is always obedient belief. True biblical belief is obedient belief. And if I'm not obeying, then I really don't have biblical faith, because the Bible equates these things. And to whom did he swear that he would not enter his rest? But to those who were disobedient. Oh, that was the problem. They disobeyed. So we see that they were not able to enter because of not disobedience, unbelief. Why? Well, because those are the same thing. If unbelief and disobedience are the same, then brethren, obedience and faith are the same. I would suggest to you then that you think about Hebrews chapter 10. In Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 23, how is it that we begin to see the effects of faltering faith? The effects of having this idea, well, I've not stopped believing, but I stop obeying. I would suggest that when we stop worshiping, we're beginning to see faltering faith. We're beginning to see that we're just kind of getting complacent in reference. Well, I don't need to. I'm a spiritual person. I don't need church. I don't need that to be a spiritual person. Well, I'm afraid that you do in order to be an obedient person to the Lord. You do need that. The Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 10, let us hold fast the confession of our faith without wavering, for he who promises faithful. And let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking our own assembling as the manner of some, but encouraging one another all the more as you see the day drawing near. Do you need to be stimulated? Do you need to be promoted? Do you need to be encouraged? If I'm going to take heed lest I fall, I need that kind of encouragement. And where am I going to find that? Well, one of the places I'm going to find that is worshiping with God's people, because it keeps me reminded of what my goal is, nearness to God. But I need to be careful, brethren, that when I look at the mistakes of these individuals in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I don't find myself repeating the same thing that they did. And if I do, how much worse will it be for me standing in the judgment bar of God, when I've got all this evidence suggestive of what I should not have done and how I should not have acted, and yet that's exactly what I did. Take your songbooks out and turn them to the number that's been selected. This matter of taking heed lest he fall is not a matter that we would say, well, that's for the weak Christians. No, that's not for the weak Christians. Well, that's for the newbie. No, that's not for the newbie. When Paul writes his letter to the church in Corinth, they have been Christians for years. And yet Paul still writes them and say, look, you have got to take heed lest you fall. You still can fall, even though you've been serving God for a number of years. You still can fall. So that tells us then that at any point in time, if I don't take heed, I can fall. Whether I've been a servant of God for 40 years or for 50 years or for 4 months or 5 months, it doesn't matter. The warning stands for every child of God. If you're here this morning and your life is not what it needs to be and we can help you make it right, let us know. Come forward. Together we stand and while we sing.